Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
The preliminary election for Boston mayor is 2 weeks away, September 14th. Now, WBUR and Radio Boston will join WCVB, the Boston Globe, the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston, to bring you a debate among the major candidates next Thursday, September 9th. Meanwhile, all this month, we are bringing you interviews, one-on-ones, with all the major candidates for mayor of Boston, and we wrap the series today with a conversation with John Barros, the city's former chief of economic development. John joins us now. John, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Sienna, it's good to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us, John. And I'm going to start by asking you a question that I've asked everyone in this series. We know that whoever wins this, John, it's going to be a first with no white men in this race. So the question is, why are you the right person to be first and the best person to lead this city in this particular moment?
Tiziana, thanks for the question. You know, I believe I'm the best person to lead the city in this particular moment because I'm ready to hit the ground running and help Boston meet our challenges, both in trying to get our economy back up and make it more equitable and just, trying to deal with COVID as we get out of this pandemic, trying to get us to making sure that we have the best school system in the country, and then trying to address affordable housing. These are all things that I have extensive experience in as a former chief of economic development, as a former executive director of the Dulles Street Neighborhood Initiative.
What does it mean to hit the ground running, John?
That means that in the first 100 days, I will make sure, in fact, that we have a plan for 3-year-old and 4-year-old seats for every Boston child that's eligible. We need to make sure that early childhood education is a priority and that we're moving on it. I've also announced a guaranteed minimum income program, a pilot, in fact, in Boston, to help our educators from birth to two to make sure that they have the kind of resources and the wages and training that they need so to get back to work and to get quality child care seats available in Boston. So all of our women, our primary caregivers for children, can get back to work and we can have our children reading by the grade three.
So that's really heavily focused on the ecosystem for our little ones. Why are you kind of focused there on those first 100 days?
It is critical that we start there as we try to, you know, improve Boston public schools. And then I've made the commitment to make sure that we have better schools. We need to invest in our school buildings. Every Boston student should have access to a world-class quality school in all of our neighborhoods that take us to a program from birth to career. I've announced a $4 billion plan to do that. There should be no reason why a parent shouldn't pick a neighborhood school. There should be no reason why your neighborhood school shouldn't be the top school in the city. That's my commitment. We also have a rich ecosystem of educational institutions in our city. So I've also announced a citywide college system to make sure that we have a college to career pathway with internships and opportunities to make sure that our students are taking advantage of the emerging jobs in our marketplace. And then finally, because if we get it right in schools, that means that Boston would have coordinated the family support services that we need to make sure that all of our children are getting to school ready to learn. That means that we have economic security, food security, health care, and that we have safety for all of our children and families.
So, John, you know, I know the Boston Globe caused a bit of a kerfuffle when they said there was no education candidate. You've just laid out a lot of priorities, sort of given us your areas of focus. Underneath it all, what is the core problem? You served on the school committee. What is the core problem with the Boston Public Schools?
Yeah, there are two issues here. One is we have a system that lays all of our social problems at the feet of our teachers without, you know, the adequate services and resources to deal with it. We as I said, you know, some people call it the, you know what they refer to Tatiana as the social determinants of health. That the things that we know if a family isn't housed properly, if they have food insecurities, if the household's not safe, et cetera, you're probably going to be on the wrong side of health disparities. Well, it's the same thing for our schools. We need to make sure that our students are ready to learn by the time they get to school. For most of our kindergartners, they get to school with a 1500 word gap. When you're talking about brown and black kids as opposed to, you know, someone from, their white counterparts, this is something that we can deal with. But we also have a high rate of housing instability in our schools, about 5,000 homeless kids, but many more thousand housing insecure children that are going to our schools. We have to marshal all of Boston's resources and supports to aim them at our family and children in our schools and give them a chance for success. And then we need to make sure that we're coordinating all of our school programs in a way that serves our most needy.
So I hear you. Those are also huge systemic issues. How does a mayor in a four-year term turn that ship?
Yeah, great question. I think the first and foremost is in investments, right? So I will float $4 billion in Boston bonds. Part of it will be green bonds to make sure that we have climate resilient school buildings. And then I will make sure we also have social justice bonds as part of the debt that we issue. We'll issue those at 2.5%. Why? Because we have AAA bond rating in our city. And as a city official, we did a great job to make sure Boston can issue some of the cheapest debt in the country. That'll cost us about $80 million a year. So we can build within the next 8 years or so a new school building in every neighborhood, making sure that there's early education that's quality, making sure that every child is reading a chapter level book at grade three, making sure a grade eight algebra is available, science, arts, making sure that our children have libraries, that they have innovation labs, science labs in their schools, art studios. We know what it takes to provide a quality school. And we also know that for many of our children, we need a full year school system, one with summer enrichment, one with longer school days and weekends to make sure that people have quality programming and enrichment that they need for their whole calendar year.
So there's a whole bunch of other stuff we need to get to, John. I'm going to move us on. And for a minute, we have got to talk about the race. I know you are aware that there are questions about viability for you. Each time a poll has come out, the latest poll from Emerson College has you at 2% among likely voters. Now, the margin of error is 3.9%. I want to note that, and I want to note 25% still undecided. But still, you're the only major candidate in single digits. How do you turn that big of a gap in 15 days?
Well, so as you said, there are many undecided. Undecided, I think, is still upwards of 25%. And this thing will break. Voters will make the decision. The most important poll will be taken on the 14th of September. Imagine if now Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley dropped out of the race because she was trailing Capuano by 14%. Or if Eric Adams, who's now the new presumed mayor of New York, dropped out because he was polling the last in the polls, I think a month out or something. I mean, these are the kinds of trends that we've seen recently with polls. I've told all of my supporters, I am going to continue to work hard, talk to voters. I'm feeling traction out here. I've gotten supports. We've increased supports. Our internal numbers are favorable. I feel good about this race and feel good that I can be one of the finalists.
You just mentioned Congresswoman Pressley, who's actually going to be on the show in a little bit. Kind of to that point, the last couple of years, John, have been years of the woman in so many ways in politics. You have publicly talked about the need to keep black men centered as well. You're the only man left among the major candidates, but that has got to be a tricky case to make right now, John. How do you argue for space for a man when women are smack in the middle of claiming space in politics right now?
You know, it's a beautiful thing, Tiziana. I am such a fan of what the women are doing, what women of color are doing, of my congresswoman, Ayanna Pressley, and her leadership. But that's not a zero-sum game. Women and women advancement and leadership doesn't mean that we can't hire or elect a black man to be the mayor of the city of Boston. In fact, that would be revolutionary in a statement itself. So it is really, I think, not only historic, but it is encouraging that we have a field of qualified candidates that would give us opportunities to send many different statements. But one of the things I heard from men of color early on in this campaign is, wow, John, we are inspired by what the women are doing. We are inspired by the movement that is happening around the country and locally by some of our women. How should black men step into this moment and do the same? How should we use them as inspiration? And that's exactly what we're saying. Yes, let's use that as inspiration to get more black men, more brown men, more black and brown boys involved in ways that can be more productive for all of us. The more of us that are involved in our democratic process, the more of us that are taking leadership, the more representative, and the more we all win.
All right, John, let's talk a little bit about the pandemic because it's the pandemic. Clearly, it's going to be an ongoing management and leadership issue for the winner of this race. You're in favor of requiring those participating in certain indoor activities to have proof of vaccination in order to participate. Why? And any concern that it's going to reinforce structural discrimination, especially when people of color are unvaccinated at higher levels?
I am absolutely in favor of vaccination. There's no question about it. And I'm also in favor of keeping us safe. And so in some of our larger venues, and particularly I'm thinking about the performing arts spaces, the spaces where you have large crowds, we need to do more than just ask people to wear masks, although that's critical. We need to actually make sure that they've been vaccinated. We know that vaccination is the best way to protect yourself, but it's not foolproof. So let's get vaccinated and get masked. And then when in places where we have to have more sustained presence by people like schools, let's make sure we keep our students and staffs safe by making sure people get vaccinated, wear masks, and get regularly tested. It is critical that we continue to test. We've dropped off on testing, and we need to make sure that testing is part of how we keep people safe in sustained locations. But you're right, Tiziana. I think before we start shutting down our economy because it is unsafe, let's make sure that we keep people safe, keep people in their jobs, and continue to get people back to work.
So how do you convince people who just don't want to get vaccinated?
Well, we've got to be careful with our rhetoric. We've got to send clear messages, not opaque messages about, you know, taking a vaccine is equating to, you know, kind of slavery or some kind of discriminatory system. You know, getting a vaccine, let's follow the science. Let's follow the data we have. Getting a vaccine keeps us safe. So leadership in messaging needs to be clear and consistent. We also need to tell people that, you know, vaccination is not enough, right? And if we are in large spaces with large crowds, and we've seen a lot of them, we just had the carnival happen in Boston. And that kind of, I started finding myself once again in spaces outside with a lot of people. So I put my mask on. I'm doing it everywhere inside I go, and I'm trying to lead by example. I think leadership should lead by example first, and then we need to make sure that we're giving people information and science to let them know that this is the right way to go.
All right, in our last little bit of time, I want to get into economic development since you served as the chief of economic development under Mayor Walsh. So 7 years in that role, you've had that shot at City Hall. What would be different in your term as mayor from your work as chief of economic development?
Yeah, no, I was honored, and it was a privilege to be able to advise then Mayor Walsh and on his policies and what he should do. But I was one of many advisors, and so it wasn't always the John way. It was the Walsh way, and he took all of our advice and made his decisions. But as the
what
mayor,
would the John way be? What would the John way be?
Yeah, the John way would be clear around, you know, investment in our schools. I believe in the human potential, and so human development would be critical. Human development and talent development is the first part to economic development, which was your question. And so it starts with people first. And then we need to make sure that we're providing opportunities for all people. So I was really happy to finish the disparity study at the city. It took 5 years because it's a 5 years look back to make sure that we have a legal document to set gender-based goals and race-based goals. So now at the City of Boston, the discretionary spend on women-owned businesses and people of color-owned businesses is $180 million a year, 25% of our discretionary total budget. Those are the kinds of policy that a John administration or Barrow's administration would bring. We would make sure to be aggressive in affordable housing to mm-hmm. make sure that we can house all Boston residents. It's something that I did all my professional life as executive director of the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative to make sure that we can develop our neighborhoods without displacing our neighbors. And then youth development to make sure that we were providing the opportunities for those in our neighborhoods to be able to be their best yeah. selves and reach their promise. Those are the types of things that John would do and a Barrow's administration would do differently and do more aggressively than a Walsh administration.
All right, we're going to have to end there. That is mayoral candidate John Barrow's. John, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Tiziana. Appreciate it.
So we have talked with all five major candidates for Boston mayor here on the show this month, and our debate with WCVB, the Boston Globe, the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston is coming next week. So here to give us kind of a wrap-up and an update on the race, the polling, endorsements, even the get-out-the-vote, WBUR's Deputy Managing Editor Todd Wallach. Todd, hey, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, so preliminary election, 15 days from now. Just catch us up on the polling. What do we know about the numbers?
Yeah, of course. It looks like a really competitive race. Of course, the top two candidates in the preliminary election will go on to the general election in November, but it's hard to predict who it will be. Emerson College and Channel 7 released a poll last week showing Counselor Michelle Wu at the head of the pack with 24% of support from likely voters, but several others were close behind. Counselor Anissa Saibi George at 18%, Acting Mayor Kim Janey at 16%, Andrea Campbell at 14%, and it might even be tighter than that. Like all polls, there's a margin of error. As you mentioned earlier, one in four people said they were undecided, so those votes are still up for grabs. And it's always difficult to predict exactly who will show up to the polls, especially in a preliminary election. In fact, when Emerson looked at just the very likely voters, the spread was even tighter. Wu led with 22% of the vote, but that was just one percentage point more than Saibi George and a few percentage points ahead of other candidates, all of which to say is it's too close to call.
All right. So that suggests that getting out the vote is going to be incredibly important, getting people to the polls, Todd. How is that shaping up so far? What can you tell us about the ground game for these candidates?
Right. Well, despite the pandemic, all five major candidates have regularly held events to meet with voters. And of course, it's easier to do that this time of year when the weather's warm and it's easier to talk to people outside. But they've also raised significant amounts of money, which in turn have allowed them to hire people to help turn out the vote. In fact, four of the five major candidates have raised well over $1 million each. The one candidate who has fallen behind in both fundraising and polling is John Barrows. His campaign finance reports show he has raised just about half as much as other candidates. And of course, as you mentioned earlier, the Emerson poll had him at just 2% in the poll, well behind other candidates.
So any specific campaign strategies that are really worth noting at this late stage before the preliminary?
Well, one huge difference is that Kim Janey is trying to set herself apart by campaigning as the incumbent mayor. Her office always calls her mayor, not acting mayor, her legal title. But being an incumbent also carries risks. I mean, she's been criticized for withholding police records, and she's drawn fire for being photographed posing for a picture at a restaurant over the weekend after enacting an indoor mask mandate. Other candidates have tried different strategies. Michelle Wu has staked out ground on the left, calling for free public transit before some other candidates, for instance. Campbell has emphasized her life story and concerns about racial inequities in the city. Saibi George has courted police unions at a time when many other Democrats are calling for shrinking police budgets. And Barrows, as you heard, talks about his lengthy resume, including experience working as the city's economic development chief for 7 years.
All right, Todd, I want to get to at least a couple of the issues. WBUR, our own polling, has shown housing to be a very important issue for voters in this race. The Spark Notes version, how are the candidates pitching to make and keep housing affordable in the city?
You're right. Housing is a huge issue in a city as expensive as Boston. And all the candidates have bold plans to try to create more affordable housing and help residents. One area where Michelle Wu stands out is her support for rent control, but that would likely require a statewide change since Massachusetts voters banned rent control decades ago. And Andrea Campbell recently told WBUR there's no appetite on Beacon Hill to change that. Meanwhile, Kim Janey, who initially sounded like she opposed rent control, seems to have shifted her position. Her campaign told the Bay State Banner she thinks the city should have local control over the issue.
Okay, I'm going to treat COVID as a given. What other key issues are influencing this election?
COVID is definitely a given. But there are many other issues boosting the economy, climate change, education, transportation. But for the most part, the candidates agree. They're all Democrats. And we've tried to lay out some of the nuances that distinguish them in our voter guide on WBUR.org.
All right. So let's talk a couple of things at once on endorsements, because, you know, candidates look forward to these key endorsements, unions, elected officials. Any that have happened that you think might move the needle for voters? And is there anyone on the sidelines that you're watching for?
It's a really good question. It's possible some of those endorsements could make a difference with some voters, especially where they have organizations that could help turn out the vote. Janey Wu and Asaibe George have all picked up endorsements from union locals, for instance. And a group called Wakanda 2 is trying to unify Black voters behind Kim Janey. But polls show that group is not monolithic. And it's worth noting that Representative John Santiago got at least a couple dozen endorsements, and he still dropped out.
And how about sitting on the sidelines?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's one person who could potentially make a big difference. Former Mayor Marty Walsh.
Dun, dun, dun.
And that probably came to your mind and other people's mind before I said it. When he stepped down in March to become Biden's labor secretary, he was pretty popular, and he built a strong campaign organization over time. But he stayed out even after John Barrows, who reminded us that he served in the Walsh administration, said he thought he had Walsh's vote. Instead, you have multiple candidates, including Barrows, all going after Walsh's supporters.
Okay, so John Santiago dropped out, and when he did, there were questions as to where his supporters and undecided Latino voters would turn. What is that looking like a month later?
It's true. One thing to keep in mind is that Santiago dropped out in part because he didn't have enough supporters to begin with, even in a divided field. And the Emerson poll shows that Latino voters remain divided, mostly between Wu, Janey, and Asaibe George. So they're not all lining up behind one candidate.
Okay, and then just briefly, regardless of who wins, as I've said, it's going to be a first. What are you watching for?
Yeah, it's true. Kim Janey already made history when she was installed as acting mayor in March, becoming both the first woman and first person of color to serve as acting mayor. Until then, every previous mayor had been a white man. Now every major candidate running identifies as a person of color, and the four candidates leading the polls are all women. So no matter who wins, it will make history.
All right. We will watch it with you. That's WBUR's Deputy Managing Director, Todd Wallach. Todd, thanks.
Thank you.